had been monitoring slowly went dark, which is a scary thing. In September 2014, after a year of watching our legal capabilities diminish, I saw Apple and Google announce that they would be moving their mobile devices to default encryption. They announced it in such a way as to suggest, at least to my ears, that making devices immune to judicial orders was an important social value. This drove me crazy. I just couldn't understand how smart people could not see the social costs to stopping judges, in appropriate cases, from ordering access to electronic devices. The Apple and Google announcement came on the eve of one of my regular quarterly sessions with the press corps that covered the FBI and the Department of Justice. I hadn't planned to talk about encryption, but I couldn't help myself. I expressed my frustration with the move to default encryption by saying, "I am a huge believer in the rule of law, but I also believe that no one in this country is beyond the law. What concerns me about this is companies marketing something expressly to allow people to place themselves beyond the law." With those comments, I joined an incredibly complicated and emotional battle. The divide between the FBI and companies like Apple can be explained in large measure by how each sees the world and the limitations of each of those perspectives. And frankly, there's not a lot of true listening going on between the parties. The leaders of tech companies don't see the darkness the FBI sees. Our days are dominated by the hunt for people planning terrorist attacks, hurting children, and engaging in organized crime. We see humankind at its most depraved, day in and day out. Horrific, unthinkable acts are what the men and women of the FBI live, breathe, and try to stop. I found it appalling that the tech types couldn't see this. I would frequently joke with the FBI going dark team assigned to seek solutions. Of course the Silicon Valley types don't see the darkness. They live where it's sunny all the time and everybody is rich and smart. Theirs was a world where technology made human connections and relationships stronger. Who doesn't love sharing cat gifts with grandma? Or ordering coffee on your app so it's ready when you walk into the Starbucks? Although I was joking, I thought the tech community did not fully appreciate the costs when good people from law enforcement were unable to use judicial orders to get evidence. I also think it would be fair criticism to say we focus too much on those costs, given the darkness outside our windows all day long. Because both sides are biased by our places in the world, I thought it critical that the resolution shouldn't be dictated by either Apple or the FBI. The American people should decide how they want to live and govern themselves. But what exactly that means as a practical matter is an incredibly hard question to answer. The collision between privacy and public safety in the encryption context touches on not just privacy and public safety, but also issues of technology, law, economics, philosophy, innovation, and international relations, and probably other interests and values. The bargain at the heart of our government has always been that privacy matters enormously, but it must yield when, with appropriate evidence and oversight, the government needs to see into private spaces to protect the community. No large part of America has ever been entirely off-limits to judicial authority. President Obama was, by background and instinct, a civil libertarian. But he could see the darkness and the danger in talking about privacy as an absolute value, as he explained publicly in Austin, Texas, in spring 2016. He said, "But the dangers are real. Maintaining law and order in a civilized society is important. Protecting our kids is important. And so I would just caution against taking an absolutist perspective on this, because we make compromises all the time. And this notion that somehow our data is different and can be walled off from those other trade-offs we make, I believe is incorrect." He dove into the issue, ordering unprecedented White House scrutiny of the clash between privacy and security. At one of several meetings he personally led on the topic in the White House Situation Room, he said that if we were headed to a place where wide swaths of American life would be judge-proof, that wasn't a decision a company should make. That would be a change in the way we live. Only the people of the United States should make such a decision. Unfortunately, President Obama ran out of time. Though the administration made some progress on the issue, including developing a technical plan called a proof of concept, to show it was possible to build secure mobile devices and still permit judges to order access in appropriate cases, He left office without deciding what to do next, including whether to seek legislation or regulation of some kind. One thing about those discussions stayed with me. In the summer of 2016, I sat in the White House Situation Room where various leaders and staffers were laying out and discussing the many dimensions of the problem with the president. The Situation Room is actually the name for a collection of offices and conference rooms that support the president and his National Security Council. But it is also the name commonly used for the conference room in which the president normally holds national security meetings. The room looks nothing like it does on television. It is really small. If the leather-wheeled office chairs are jammed together, maybe 10 people can join the president at the table, and they will all need breath mints. The seating arrangement for each meeting was dictated by nameplates put on the table by the Situation Room staff before the meeting began. I have been there dozens of times under three presidents and still can't explain the placement of the nameplates. In back-to-back meetings, I have moved to another seat because there was a different design for the second meeting and my nameplate moved. Nobody sat at the opposite end of the table from the president because that would block the video screen and camera that allowed senior leaders to join from the road. They would appear on the screen in a Hollywood Squares setup, visible only from the waist up. Knowing this, I once attended from Hawaii wearing a suit jacket and tie and my bathing suit. From time to time, the sit room staff would pull smaller wood chairs up to the end of the table farthest from the president. I called these the kids' chairs, and because I was not a cabinet secretary, I was often assigned one. Kind colleagues would sometimes offer me their big kid seats to avoid the hilarious spectacle of the FBI giraffe sitting on a tiny chair. Around the walls, there was room for another 10 or 12 participants, but the room was so small that their knees nearly touched chairs at the table. And so here we were, in the waning days of the Obama administration, packed in to talk about encryption. Near the end of the meeting, the president spoke up. He had a look of discovery on his face. "You know, this is really hard," he said to no one in particular. "Normally I can figure these things out, but this one is really hard." I had two reactions to the comment, both of which I kept to myself. "No kidding," was the first reaction. A whole lot of smart people had been banging on this incredibly complicated issue for years. My second reaction was to be struck by the president's breathtaking confidence. To my eye, at least, he wasn't puffing or trying to show off. He also wasn't being self-deprecating or sarcastic in the way President Bush might have. He really did believe that he, Barack Obama, could always figure out the hardest stuff. He couldn't figure this one out, which surprised him. "Wow," I thought. I really didn't know what to make of it. That much confidence, the belief that he personally can solve